What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Jessica Willis Fisher is a singer-songwriter living in Nashville, Tennessee. Her childhood as the eldest of 12 siblings and member of a family band was marked by great tumult and abuse, despite spending several years in the public eye. Jessica would eventually free herself and deal with all that came next, which includes coming to terms with her abuse, navigating the media, working to see her abuser imprisoned, and healing from the harm. The Broken Cycle Media team has immense gratitude for Jessica's time, energy, and all the awareness she's bringing with this conversation to intrafamilial abuse.
I'm Jessica Willis Fisher. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I am a singer-songwriter, author, dog mom, fiddle player, and all kinds of different artsy things. I spend a lot of my time now sharing my story of my upbringing and survivorship because I love making something meaningful and beautiful out of the hardest things that life throws at us. I was born on the south side of Chicago. I'm the oldest of 12 kids. The first 7, 8, 9 years of my life, fairly normal. We went to my grandfather's church on the weekends. My mom stayed home with us. She was an education major, so she was schooling us at home. Dad was working 9 to 5. And around my 9th year, there was a lot of changes. There had been some tragedy in my extended family. There was a wrongful death suit. My father got some money and he retired. We ended up moving to Tennessee, and we went from a little small house in Chicago with 5 and 6 kids to Tennessee, had a huge house, horses, we did music, we did dance, we had all these teachers. 6 more children were born. And about 4 or 5 years after we moved to Tennessee, that house burned down. So just the childhood itself has a lot of change and a lot of different things going on. During my childhood and teen years, we got into Irish dance, river dance, that sort of thing. We did that pretty much as a family. Initially, it was the oldest 2, 3 kids, and then 4, 5, 6 kids, and so on. We would do little performances and competitions until the year 2012. The other thing I would throw in there is singing with the family and singing at church. And that was probably the extent of my public performance. I didn't really become familiar with being in the public eye until I was in my late teens, early 20s. We would go to the grocery store and people would comment to my mom, straight to us kids, you guys should have your own TV show, because we're standing there with 8, 9 kids getting groceries and it's 3 carts and it's heaped high. It was just not something that people saw every day. Basically, at some point, my dad listened to that. In about 2011, we did our first TV show that was a series on our family. My dad had been adjacent to TV work for a few years. He was working on starting a business of his own, which lasted a number of years and then folded. During that time, he made connections in the TV industry. So the years 2011-ish through 2016 were like the public-facing years where we had a family band on TV. I personally did not enjoy the experience of reality TV. There's cameras in your quote, daily life. And I think lots of people would not enjoy that experience. And really, I have to realize now that if you're going through abuse and you're keeping it squashed down and you're also being pushed to perform not only on stage in increasing amounts, but now in your own home to perform a happy family, it's just deeply uncomfortable. My dad was very abusive in about every way that a person can be. He was sexually abusive to me from my earliest memories. And so along with the escalation and change of all the other things in my life, the different periods and the different seasons, there was an escalation of abusive behavior. He was sexually abusive until I was about 16. My initial sexual abuse memories are not physically painful. I did not feel like I was in danger. It was confusing. It was something that I didn't understand. I do remember the urge to want to tell my mom what had happened, but I didn't even know what I would have said. I would have to jump ahead to around 8 or 9 years old before the actions of what was happening had escalated to the point where I wanted to escape my body. I now have the vocabulary of dissociation, and the abuse itself was traumatizing in the moment, physically and emotionally. That really marks a big change from how it initially started. I try to explain to people that didn't have pre-verbal abuse, there's new experiences every day. That's what a child's life is. And you look to your caregivers, your parents and your family and your community with trust and love, usually, especially if there's not that intense violence and fear to start. If there's a trusting love to start and an innocence, that creates this gap that abusers can use to take actions or groom the victim's inexperience and confusion. Totally takes advantage of that. I was years into being sexually abused before I even really started to grasp, oh my gosh, there's something morally wrong. There's something shameful about this. There's something that really should be communicated. I talk about it feeling like there was a bomb strapped to my chest, that as things became more public, it just made things so much more dire emotionally and eventually physically. My dad was allowed to get away with a lot of things. And it's not like people are like, fine, we're cool with you abusing children. It's more like unhealthy, toxic things that occur are normalized. I know it's a very touchy personal subject. Some people's faith is the best thing about their life. Hopefully it makes them a better person and it makes the whole world better for it. But some people's religious beliefs or religious communities or worldviews are such bad news for particularly women and children in their community. That just really came into play in my story, initially starting with my grandpa's church. It was a physical building. There were a lot of well-meaning people there. There's a lot of things that looked fairly traditional. Nobody would be going, whoa, this is so fringe. It was pretty middle of the line in a conservative system. But it ended up where we were basically in a home church, I think also with a lot of other well-meaning people. But my dad was under the radar still in many ways. He constantly sought out a way for him to have more and more authority within his own home, authority within the community. We were prepping for the end times and we had semi-automatic guns and assault rifles. Our relationships were highly policed by dad. I did not have my own car. I was earning money, but any money that I made was under my dad's control. I didn't have a phone until I turned 22, 23. I was not allowed to go on dates or just hang out with anybody at all without my parents' permission or knowledge or checking in. I'm about to be 24. There's so much control and such a lack developmentally. I'm more like 14 years old because I haven't had my own independence. I don't have that freedom and that life experience. I cannot really talk about this without bringing up my now husband, whom I met about a year and a half before I got out. His dad
was running the Grand Ole Opry, which is a musical show in Nashville, radio show. That was one of the things that was happening for us those last few years, like 2014, 2015, when I was with the family band. I just look at the gigs we played and just feel tired. We were on the road, we were doing TV, we were performing, we were doing all sorts of things, which, by the way, is a tactic. Keep people busy so they can't slow down and feel their feelings or reach out for help or build community. I met my husband backstage at the Opry and then met again a number of months later. And that second time really grabbed my attention. He came for dinner at my family's place with his parents. That function was like, oh, this is a band getting to spend time with the guy who runs this. The fact that Sean and I got to meet was a side note. But I had to do the calculation of like, all right, I'm going to slip in my email in the conversation. And he mentioned he was single. And it was like, there's like a little bit of flirting going on, but everybody's there. My dad's there, family's there. There's music conversations going on and everything. And I made sure to come off as normal as I could, even though I'm one of 12. If you've seen Sound of Music, we had our own little version of where we all had to line up when we were meeting people. I literally met my husband by saying like, I'm Jessica and I'm 22, standing in a line with all my siblings. So kind of embarrassing, but long story short is that we had a connection and we were breaking the rules of what I was allowed to do. I was allowed to send one email per week with permission. And of course, that's not what I was doing. I was communicating with him in ways that still probably seemed a little quirky to him, but were way past what I was really allowed to be doing. Me being the oldest, me being female, there was this like, my daughters can't date. If you want to date my daughter, you have to wrestle me. Ever since I was a kid and growing up, and there were a number of people that I felt drawn to or maybe had a pen pal relationship with or would cross paths with through music or through dance or something. There could be feelings of wanting it to be more, but again, it was severed in some way by my dad. He's never allowed to come around again, or I'm going to pull out my gun if I see him again, or just things like that. It had happened over and over again. And that's where I got the courage / determination to not obey all of those rules and to get away with as much as I could under the radar, which really set me up to be on a collision course where I was living a double, triple life because there was the outside. What does the TV camera and the audience see? The jokes, the smiles, the wholesome song and dance that we're doing. Then there's the horrible instances of blow-ups right before we go on stage or having to cover up a bruise with makeup. And then me trying to be normal when ever getting the chance to interact with someone else, wanting to be free, wanting to get away, but really feeling like, remember that bomb strapped to my chest? It's like, if I get close to someone, what happens if this blows up? And what does blowing up mean? Does that mean we all die in a standoff? Or does that mean it's a scandal or my dad actually shoots someone who's sneaking around the house? Like, what does that look like? It was very unhealthy. Just reflecting on what that sort of tension and anxiety and danger chemically does to your body over time. I will be trying to heal my poor nervous system for the rest of my life. But getting to know Sean, he came to some church services. He would come to our shows. Dad stopped approving of him coming around pretty quickly, but we stayed in contact. When I met him, he was the hospitality director at an experiential therapy retreat where people were going to work through major traumas, and there were all of these cutting edge experts on all sorts of things. And he was able to go, okay, theoretically asking for a friend, would this be normal? Or what does this mean if I see this? He was getting expert homework and he would send me books. He would send me articles. I was starting to pick up some vocabulary and stuff. He didn't see abuse happening in our house. But he eventually got to the point where he asked me through a letter. I basically confirmed without going into it too much. And he was like, okay, well, are you safe? And I was like, yes, I'm safe. Of course, I was not. Things were getting more and more violent. And it was this countdown of, am I going to get the courage to get out quick enough before I die in this situation? I had tried to physically leave a number of times leading up to that. One time we were traveling on the tour bus. I got in trouble with Dad and he hit me in the face, which he hadn't done up to that point. I was going to get off the bus, but we were literally on the side of a wintry road. I finally got the courage, taking some tangible steps to leave that home and that band in April, just a few days before my 24th birthday. Sorry if this is triggering. My dad took off his belt and was, quote, spanking me. I was like, that is the last time that happens. And I didn't feel full of courage. It was more like leaving my body. It was more like this knowing of it's never going to happen again. It almost felt like the decision was made for me. I have to leave. I can't stay here. He was like, you can't leave until I said I'm leaving. And then it was like, fine, we're kicking you out. I remember them saying, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? And I was like, well, give me a phone. I really didn't have a plan. The last thing my dad said to me that day when I left was, when you mess up your life and get pregnant and come back, we'll forgive you. That's how I left. I called this relative and just said, can I come over? And she was like, sure. And I was like, can I bring a bag? She was like, sure. That was a huge deal for me because I just spoke to someone on the outside and said I was coming. It really was like, well, if I don't show up, at least they'll know where to look for my body sort of thing. That was just crazy. It was days of being homeless. Every single thing that I had every day of my life was gone immediately. And as soon as I did get out, Sean, his family, a bunch of people were there to point me towards those experts, get me in therapy, urge me to share my story. After I left, I got into therapy. One of my first therapists said, maybe we can try making a timeline. There's just so much jumbled. A lot of this doesn't feel like it's set in time. And it's so visual, it's so overwhelming, but putting language, putting time and putting an order to the chaos can be really helpful. And she was so right. There's so many different modalities in therapy and people have such different experiences, but that was so helpful for me. One of the ways to describe those few months was for me being educated as quickly as possible about the fact that people who do this never stop doing it. I had to really let it sink in that my dad was going to continue to abuse in any way that he could, anyone that he had access to, and that's how I needed to respond. It wasn't okay for me to just get away with my physical life and safety. It was an obligation and a responsibility towards him being free and at large with the rest of my family in tow and how dangerous it was for them to all still be in there. I want to believe that I was on the road to be able to pick up the phone myself and trigger that entire thing of my own accord. There were a number of times my husband, Sean, and different people would check in and be like, are you at a place where you can talk about it? And I would just go into a panic attack. It felt like going back in there, just trying to open my mouth and say the things that happened was still so overwhelming and traumatizing. But there was someone, they have so far chosen not to be public about this, but someone that we knew, friend of the family, part of the church community, he did not firsthand witness abuse happening in my house. As far as I know, this person also did not see anything firsthand, but they had talked with some of my siblings. They had correctly put their finger on what was going on, whether it was their gut, whether it was red flags that they saw, things that they got confirmed. My dad was interacting with other people in the other families and our church group, and he was just like, this is not okay. We met and kind of had a conversation about talking about it without talking about it. And he was like, I basically have some things on my heart. And I was like, I think you should do what you need to do. Very shortly after that, he ended up calling into a hotline and reporting my dad for suspicion of child sexual abuse. To my understanding, this hotline, immediately there was someone maybe in the sheriff's office that had heard of my family and crossed paths with us years ago. And they flagged it and were like, hey guys, this could be a lot based on their religious beliefs, based on the fact that they're on TV, they have a lot of kids. If this is true, it's really bad. And we need to be very careful about how this is handled. That meant it got bumped up to TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And within 24 hours of them being told about the hotline call, TBI sprung into action and they talked to the original reporter. They talked to then my now husband, Sean. They talked to a couple other people that knew my family. And then they requested to talk to me immediately. And they were like, look, we need someone to firsthand speak to this to really change everything. And so I talked to them It felt like a million years. It's probably like 3-4 hours, something really long and laborious. But they listened to everything that I said. And I just remember thinking, I've got to say everything I possibly can. And thank goodness I've been working my butt off in therapy, because otherwise I probably would have given them incorrect information. Here's an example. I did not know that technically I was a survivor and victim of rape of a child. So people have heard the word rape. It's a very hard word to hear, but technically rape of a child is different. Its definition is even different in different states. The word molested somehow got into my vocabulary, but I would have been incorrect in answering specific questions initially. So I just told them everything that I had learned, everything that I was articulating, everything that I could remember, and where the guns were hidden. The fact that my dad was extremely violent and the fact that we were very religious. My father beat my mother. And like, I was just trying to help them understand, especially based on what you'll see on the surface. This is really serious. And we were trained to be ready for cops to come take us away because we were, quote, homeschooling from an early age. So this is not your typical thing. This is more like going in and busting up a cult than anything else. They responded with such intensity, clarity, and I only have really good things to say about them. And I just feel really lucky. I have nothing to say negative in general for the agents, but it comes down to this individual agent. Have they been trained? Do they understand the nuances of this situation? It was about a 3-4 month window between leaving my family's house and the whole investigation starting. From there, I just had to sit and wait. And it was a little bit convoluted. Every day felt like an age. I was separate from the rest of my family at that point, but they were on tour. The investigation was starting and they were trying to track down where my family was. The media didn't report it all correctly, but my dad was basically hitchhiking, which technically made him a fugitive. He knew they were trying to find him. I got a call from either the DA or a TBI agent. They said, we've got him, he's arrested. And I remember asking, what did you use to arrest him? And they confirmed that they took one of the things that I told them about in my testimony and made the arrest warrant with that. And they were like, all right, get ready. A couple hours, it's gonna hit the TV. And it did, and it was insane. There was a moment where Dad's arrest hit the news. It was on TV in a matter of hours. It was crazy to see a mugshot. It was so surreal, so scary. The indictments. There are certain things that are supposed to be redacted or certain things that are supposed to be not leaked in the press. There was something that was put online that was, for all practical purposes, not redacted. There was this flurry online at this one point of like, oh my gosh, these are who the victims are, and just speculation. And I was able to meet with the DA once or twice, the district attorney who was prosecuting the case. What a badass. I didn't have to give another testimony. I did give them something I had written, just in case I missed it in the original tornado of trying to tell you everything I could think of. So that was added into the record. They did an investigation over a number of weeks. They confiscated the computers and phones and all the digital devices. They talked to different people in my family. Almost everybody in my family cooperated and gave corroboration. That really moved things forward. They were going to bring over 100 counts is what they threatened him with. The idea was, we may not be able to prove all 100, but you're not getting away with this. There was concrete evidence discovered that as hard as it was that existed, it meant we were able to get a plea deal. He pled down to 4 counts. I can't actually make justice in this situation. It will never give me the childhood I should have had. It will never mean that those things didn't happen. It's never going to be okay or be right. But he was going to have to say guilty. That's how a plea works. You can't be maintaining your innocence. That would have driven us to trial. And so I decided to attend my dad's sentencing because I was like, this will change everything. It's kind of like pigs flying. Like, it's impossible unless I see it happen with my own eyes, because what has gotten us to this point is him continuing, not only in the actions, but in him denying everything, all these things. I was offered the opportunity to give an impact statement. And I still, at that point, felt like what would I even say? I'm still processing the reality of what happened to me. It's 24, 25 years of backlog. My choice and the thing that was right for me was to do a lot more therapy and then be comprehensive about putting the whole thing out through my work that I continue to do. I was using my voice for so many years to tell a story that kept me in harm's way, in bondage, in shame of that secret. I had come to writing songs and writing poetry. I was exposed to it young, and I took to it because it was a way of working out what I was feeling. I don't know if I would be here today if I hadn't found those things and had access to those things. I am a solo singer-songwriter now. 2022 was a big year for me because I officially decided to make music again with my own face, my own voice, my own story. Not every song is about childhood sexual abuse, but about trauma, about recovering from things, about finding the joy in life, about reclaiming my voice quite literally and doing it publicly. At one point, I was like, do I just move to the other side of the world and change my name and hide? Because it was so public. It was like, am I really going to turn around and face not only what my dad did and the whole family band reputation and all of that, but the old version of me? And really, it was like me versus the blonde, smiling lead singer of the Willis Clan and how I didn't feel like her anymore. I was also validating who that girl really was, what she was really going through. And for me, even if nobody else ever saw it, writing my book and writing the music that ended up on that record is what I needed to do for me, because that little invisible girl at 9 who was scared in her body, I had to figure out a way to integrate that version of me because I'm still her. Then the young adult who was told she was the problem, she went through so much trauma. In some ways, that was the most traumatic thing up until that point, right? And then reckoning with the media and the shame and the narrative and it feeling so much bigger and being like, this is going to follow me around the rest of my life. What do I even do? I love music and I love storytelling, but how can I do that in a healthy way that's not going to re-trigger me? And how do I not be taken advantage of? And so I just needed to be gentle with myself. Songwriting was the first thing that came back that allowed me to open up to music again, because it's all about the song. It's all about the storytelling and the truth telling.
History is written at the hands of those who win. The battle must be over for the writing to begin. Take a piece of paper and open up a vein. The feather and the finger pulls against the grain.
Towards the beginning, I did a lot of reading and a lot of writing. The book that I wrote really was born initially just out of therapy. I was doing therapeutic homework. My book is Unspeakable, Surviving My Childhood and Finding My Voice. It was really, really empowering to take those steps and to have that. It feels like closure, but I think a lot of times when we think we want closure, we just want meaning. And that is so transformative. The story's not done. And lots of things sound like tragedies or mysteries if you close the book halfway through. Like, you have to keep going. You have to see what comes next. When you think this thing is impossible, I can't possibly survive it. And then you do, it shifts your whole perspective. Of course, here I am still living now going, okay, now what? I have more to lose. I have so many ideas. There's still so many things I want to do. I'm just getting started. I think a big chunk of the work that I still have ahead of me is a reckoning with more of the religious stuff. And I feel the pull to try to articulate for people who have been in a similar system to me or the same system and have only ever had it work for them and seen the positive iterations of it. But just to highlight what happens, what you're risking when children, particularly like a female child, is raised to believe that their body does not belong to them, that it belongs first to God and then to their father and are under the authority of their father until they're married. It's interesting to go back now that the story has changed a lot. It's very chilling now to watch footage of the young children running around our house and us singing about love or faith or family and realizing there's such a cognitive dissonance. I've heard some people say, oh, I had a feeling when I first met your dad, or I knew something was wrong even just seeing the show. But far and away, so many more people coming up after shows, standing in line at meet and greets saying, I wish I was in your family. Far more people thought it was wholesome and thought it was inspiring and all above board. It's almost like, well, oh my gosh, if I was doing that, I would never invite cameras into my home. It's like, well, you're using your normal brain that would never think of abusing a child when you calculate that question. But we need to remember that it's not the same sort of brain. The biggest question that I get, well, why didn't you leave? I was a child when it all started. So one of my answers is I was 3, I was 5, I was 9, I was 16. And it's not to say that sometimes a 9-year-old or a 16-year-old doesn't try to leave, but the complicated nature of the foster care system, the police, it's still tough to figure out so many things that you lose when you're a child in an abusive situation. You don't just miss out on the healthy environment, developmental milestones. There's a lot of things that were just precluded. If you don't experience, for example, childhood sexual abuse, you're one of the lucky ones. And I can guarantee you that someone that you know and love, your child, your friend, the person that you are with one day, people around you that you know and love have dealt with it or will. And so we want to have tools in our toolbox. We want to be able to not be a well-meaning person that unfortunately plays into the misunderstandings that sometimes allow these things to go on. Hearing some stories, learning what some of the patterns are, that's a pretty sometimes quick and effective antidote to realize 90% of children who experience sexual abuse, it's coming from someone they love and know. Our prevention should help shift things so that people are not taken advantage of because they're unsuspecting and they don't actually know what the data is. They don't actually know that the most common thing is it's going to be a pastor, it's going to be a grandfather, it's going to be an uncle, it's going to be a brother. People that think, well, I would never stay with a violent partner, I would never this. It's okay, who's the person that you are most vulnerable with and you love? Now imagine that specific relationship going bad and choosing whether you're going to leave the love of your life. That's a step closer to what the reality is more like. Sometimes there's work that can only be done when we open our eyes and get really brave, courageous, and for a time go in with the purpose of, how do we stop this from happening? How do we understand how it happens? And I get some people just say, I can't go there. Sarah and Nippy of A Little Bit Culty, I was on their show and I've gotten to meet them now. And one of the things that they say is whenever you feel yourself having the reaction, like, I would never, and you feel safe and removed from something, a lot of times that can be an indication that you're actually vulnerable. People can find me. I am sometimes out on the road performing music live. JessicaWillisFisher.com. I'm on the socials, Instagrams normally where you'll see me.
Your tenacity and your resiliency are immense. I can't wait for the next chapter, the next book, the next album, everything. You are such an inspiration and a motivation. Thank you so much for all of your time and energy today.
Thank you for making the time and the effort to make a place such as this, and then for letting me be a part of it. It's always worth it, I think, to engage with these conversations, and it can take a lot out of you. Not everybody is there in good faith or really knows how to create that safe space. I've definitely felt more of that today. This has been great.
According to a 2017 People magazine article, the investigation against Jessica's father began in August 2016, resulting in his arrest in September of the same year. He would eventually plead guilty to 4 counts of child rape in July of 2017. As a result, he received two 25-year sentences for two counts and two 40-year sentences on the other two counts. Those sentences are served at the same time with no leeway in length, giving Jessica's abuser a total of 40 years in prison.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
At the point where we recorded, technically it was an open FBI investigation, but it was pretty much dormant. The calls had ceased for a number of months. They started back up sometime in 2022. I remember my mom calling me and telling me that they started receiving these calls again. I immediately leapt to action. I had said that I had an idea of maybe who the caller was, but it was pure speculation. I'm glad that I did that because I was very much wrong.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.